Okay, I'll start with just a few bits of housekeeping before we move into the substance of today. Hopefully people read closely my hortatory email on the brief exercises. We will also have more information to come by next week in terms of remarks on paper one. Professor McDonald is at a conference, so she will be absent today. She sends her regrets. The final bit of housekeeping to note is that, as you can tell from the syllabus, today's topic is causation, arguably the most important topic of the course, perhaps. The important thing is that today's lecture gives a sort of philosophical overview of the problems that the idea or the notion of causation has. And then we'll have two guest lectures by, let's say, Harvard's world experts on causation in the social sciences. We'll have a lecture by Professor Peter Hall next, former director of the European Studies Center, on what you might call causation with small n. You know, sort of, how can you get causal inference from a small n study, from case studies, which is probably something which a lot of you will be doing in your own work. Some of you may be undertaking a more statistical approach, and then we have a lecture by Professor Chris Winship, affiliated with IQSS and a chairholder in sociology, and he'll talk about causal inference in a large N case, right, in a more statistical way. So those are both lectures on sort of how to get causal inference from your data, small n or large n, case study or statistical. That's how to get causal inference. Before we move into how to get causal inference, we might want to worry about what in the world causal inference is, or what causation is. Right? So we have a philosophical overview of the problems that's supposed to generate a bit of puzzlement. Hopefully we'll be puzzled by the end of the day. And then we might take a step back and then move into sort of the more nuts and bolts aspects and figure out whether or not we can come to some kind of resolution, whether the puzzles that I'll try to provoke today are in some sense minimized or solved by the strategies that Professor Hall or Professor Winship will put on the table. Okay, causation. More importantly, we'll talk about causal problems, right? Problems with the idea of causation. Outline for today, as usual, the arc so far. Then we'll move on to really the topic, right, sort of mainstream view of how causation is supposed to work, the so-called counterfactual analysis. We'll pick out as a sort of set piece the super simple version of the counterfactual analysis. I'll raise objections so that we can try to resist that version. Step four, the counterfactual analysis in a more sophisticated way, right? See whether or not we can respond to those objections by wheeling out a more sophisticated version of the counterfactual analysis. I'll raise trouble for that. More resistance, even to the more sophisticated notion. Then we'll figure out whether or not this debate is a kind of irresolvable one because we have two concepts of causation, right? It could be the case that we have not just one notion of causation that we're trying to explain, but we have many different ones, or at least two. If that's the case, then perhaps the objections I raise are objections to an imperialistic, univocal notion of causation, and we might have piecemeal different notions of causation which are resistant to these objections. I'll finally end with a brief appetizer, a brief note on whether or not it isn't just two concepts of causation, but whether or not there's three. Whether or not there's a particular kind of causality at work in intentional action. That'll be something which we'll just have to float. Okay, the arc so far. Right, as it, of course, the topic today is causation. And one way of bridging this is to think about how many of the readers that we've read, of many of the writers we've read, right, their goal is to issue an explanations which are causal. They want to pick out causes. This is the notion operative in Jackson and Pettit, right? The kind of explanation that structural explanations are supposed to be causal explanations. They want to take that for granted. The same occurs for Liszt and Speakerman. The same occurs for Elster. Right? For these authors, it seems like the notion of explanation at issue is a causal notion. Right? The same occurs for Sass and Farrajon with rational choice theory. It seems like the same occurs with Cohen and functionalist explanation. And it seems like the same occurs with the theory of ideology in Rosen. Right? One more thing about it is, for these authors, the relevant form of explanation that they're either attacking or defending is supposed to be a causal notion of explanation. But we can also think of explanation, or at least we're willing to entertain the notion that explanations can be non-causal. This is what we get in Skinner and Winch, it seems. That when we interpret an action, when we explain an action by issuing interpretations, those are not supposed to be causal interpretations or causal explanations. It's some other kind of explanation. Similarly, there seems to be the view in Friedman, right, the instrumentalist view, that all you need for explanation might just be something like reliable prediction. Well, reliable prediction is not causation, or it doesn't have to be. So even in Friedman, it seems like there's some kind of notion of explanation as non-causal. Now, that forces us to the question, fine, we have different theories that are sort of purport to be causal, and different, or approaches that purport to be causal, and different approaches that purport to be non-causal. But we still want to figure out what causation is anyway. In a certain sense, a lot of the authors who've been in the causal camp have taken it for granted that we have a certain notion of causation. It's unchallenged, right? That's the fixed point. The question is, how can we understand, let's say, holism, so that holism fits into whatever our notion of causation is? Well, now we are in a position to ask, well, what in the world is causation? Or what would a causal explanation have to be? Okay, so the very intuitive, the very mainstream view is that the right way of thinking about causation is to think about it in terms of the counterfactual analysis. Now, before we move into it, in terms of its content, what does it mean to offer an analysis in this sense? What is an analysis? What is an analysis in the most general sense of the term? You know, you write a lot of papers that are supposed to be quote-unquote analytical papers. What is an analysis? Yeah?
An attempt to understand something.
Good. By what means? When you analyze a poem, what do you do to it?
Break it down into pieces.
You break it down into pieces, right? An analysis is a way of understanding which basically works by breaking something into its parts. And you see how it works by looking at its parts. That might be the general form of an analysis. You analyze a poem by looking at how particular lines and images work with other particular lines and images. Now, in a philosophical sense, what's an analysis? In the philosophical sense, it works very similarly. It's just a more specific version. You might say a philosophical analysis is the attempt at issuing the necessary and sufficient conditions for the correct application of a term. You want to figure out, basically, when it's right and when it's wrong to use a word. So you might do an analysis of the concept of a bachelor. What does it mean to be a bachelor? What is a bachelor? What would be the rules, necessary and sufficient, for the correct usage of the word bachelor? And you might think, you probably should think, that whatever those rules are, they have to pick out something like an unmarried male. So you have the word bachelor, and you want to break it apart and figure out how to use the word by issuing necessary and sufficient conditions. And you might say a bachelor, or X is a bachelor if and only if X is an unmarried male. You have some, typically you have some amorphous, controversial word, like bachelor, let's say, and you want to figure out how to use it, and you boil it down to its parts, simpler elements, and you might think, okay, I want to know how to use the word bachelor. I'm going to supply necessary and sufficient conditions that involve unmarried male. The concept of the unmarried and the concept of the male. And that gets me the rules for the correct application of the term bachelor. That's very simple, of course. The harder part is we want to get at a correct analysis, in that sense, of the idea of A causes B, or A is a cause of B, or causation is... What are the conditions for the correct application of the notion of causation? Okay, the super simple version, the counterfactual analysis. Event A is a cause of event B, if and only if, okay, that's a signal that we're in for an analysis, right? Event A is a cause of event B, if and only if B depends on A in this sense. Were it the case that A hadn't occurred, B wouldn't have occurred. Right? If A hadn't happened, B wouldn't have happened. If that is true of some A and B, then we are licensed to say, if this is right, that A is a cause of B. Okay, what do people think about this so far? The super simple version. Do people find it intuitively appealing? I mean, does it map on to the way we use the word cause? You know, A is a cause of B. I mean, so it should be intuitively appealing. I mean, one would hope it is, if it enjoys something like a mainstream adherence. So we should think now, we'll raise objection now, whether or not that intuitive appeal is in some way misguided. Now, before we move into the objections, we should just pick apart what exactly that super simple view comes to. Right? The idea is that A causes B if B depends on A. We use the words if and only if. So one thing to worry about is whether or not that super simple version could be even further simplified. Does the dependence have to be both necessary and sufficient? That's what's registered by the if and only if, right? The if and only if is registers the idea that the dependence is both necessary and sufficient. But we can ask whether or not the better view is something more loose, something less stringent, where the dependence only has to be necessary for causation, or where the dependence only has to be sufficient. So that's something to think about, right? When we're thinking about the counterfactual analysis, we can think about sort of uber simple versions where it's just a necessary condition or it's a sufficient condition, as opposed to being both. The other thing to notice, I mean, I think that this will definitely have to come out in section, definitely will come out in section, is the weirdness of a counterfactual conditional, right? Were it the case that A hadn't occurred, B wouldn't have occurred. Right? Notice that the verbs are what you might call in the subjunctive. That's different than what sometimes is referred to as the material conditional. I only pick that out just as tags. We don't have to rely upon them here. But just notice the difference between these two types of sentences. If I am not at the mall, the sun has set. Let's say it's true. Maybe I'm the kind of person who only goes to the mall... who is always at the mall during daylight, or who is never at the mall when it's evening. Right. That could be true. If I'm not at the mall, the sun has set. But we wouldn't want to say that the sun's setting depends upon my being at the mall. Maybe. Now, think about it differently. Were I not at the mall, the sun would have set. This is just a mark that we have to be careful about the kinds of verbs we're using when we're talking about counterfactuals. Between what you might call straightforward indicatives and then subjunctives. That's what the subjunctive registers, the counterfactual nature, the contrary to fact nature of the conditional. Okay, let's work. I started with the super simple version, then we can have the sort of uber simple version. Dependence as necessary, right? So here we have A is a cause of B only if B depends on A. So the dependence relation is a necessary feature of the causal relation. this should be, you know, for in some cases, this should be quite intuitive. This is an example brought out in Strevens's paper, but he's referring to the so-called early Lewis. I'm going to call this example Sylvie and Bruno number one. It's the early Lewis. So here's the hypothesis. Bruno's throw is a cause of the jar's breaking only if the jar's breaking depends on Bruno's throw. Now we have a fun picture. This is supposed to be a causal diagram. The arrows represent causal relations, if they're full like that. Right? Sylvie throws, breaks the jar. That's an event I call J. And we have Bruno who throws, and he's thrown off the left field. We have Paul the putts, and he's just throwing stuff all over the place. Now it's natural, if this is sort of the picture of the world, we should say, well, B is not a cause of J. You might say B, or B's throw, Bruno's throw, doesn't satisfy the necessary condition. The jar's breaking doesn't hang on Bruno's throw. His throw is going off into left field. So, given the necessity of dependence, B is not a cause of J, nor is P. I mean, this picture of certain events in the world seem to be well described by the sentence above. The truth of the picture is going to be brought out by the hypothesis above it. Now, what about S? We're working so far with the idea that A causes B only if B depends on A. Right. I'm going to take out Bruno and put in Sylvie. Okay. So far, what can we say about S? What can we say about Sylvie's throw? Are we licensed to say that Sylvie caused the jar breaking?
Yes.
Who said that? Go ahead, say more.
I think the dependence exists that if Sylvie had not thrown to break the jar, then the jar would not have broken.
I think that might, from the picture, that's
right. From the picture.
Right.
Conceivably, if Sylvie had not thrown to break the jar, there's a possibility that Bruno would have thrown to break the jar instead. But given the actual paths of throwing that existed,
exactly,
Sylvie was the only cause of the jar breaking.
So I think that's right. The picture suggests that. I think in virtue of the picture, if this is a picture of the world would be there for well described so far by saying that Sylvie is the cause of J. The important thing to realize, or a modification of that, or a qualification we want to make with that, is that that view is not licensed by the notion that causation requires dependence. Just because that notion is articulating a necessary condition, not a sufficient one. Just trying to be a little bit just niggling here, right? The issue is just that the thought so far articulates a necessary condition. That's what's picked out, registered by the only if, da-da-da-da-da. In order for us to get to the further claim that S caused J, we need to figure out what the relevant sufficient condition would be. Right. Now, of course, the picture itself suggests what the sufficient condition would be. But we don't yet have a principle for the application of that conclusion. Or we don't have a principle for the derivation of the conclusion until we have a more beefed up version of the counterfactual analysis. Because here, the counterfactual analysis was just articulating a necessary condition. Probably an obvious point. Okay. Well, we want to say that Sylvie caused, or that S caused J. Right? In virtue of that picture, we want to say that S caused J. Now, how can we justify it? Or what principle would allow us? Well, as I just suggested, we need to think of dependence as then a sufficient condition. Or we might go this way, right? A is a cause of B if B depends on A. Sylvie is a cause of J, or S is a cause of J if J depends on A. S. Here's the JS example. Oh, that's a wrong. Sylvia's throw is a cause of the jar's breaking if the jar's breaking depends on Sylvia's throw. Dependence, we say that it's sufficient on this proposal. Same example, same picture of the world, and we're supposed to conclude, in light of the principle and in light of the picture of the world, that S is a cause of J, just in the way that Sam suggested. S is a cause of J. If S hadn't occurred, J wouldn't have. That's what we're supposed to, that's supposed to be suggested by the picture. And it's suggested by the picture exactly because Bruno's going that way, Paul's going these other ways, and there's no other arrows affecting J, right? It's not as though there were some other pitcher over here, right? Okay, but we might want to think about counterexamples. Is dependence sufficient for causation? Right? That's the question. That's a hypothesis. The principle that we're purporting to endorse. Dependence as sufficient for causation. Well, let's think about how to resist it. I'll call this example SB number 2, Sylvia Bruno number 2. This is a case of preemption. If the world had a picture like this, right? The previous one had Bruno throwing off in the left field. But if the picture of the world was like this, what do we have? Paul is still going left and right, all over the place. Picture where it says that S causes J. But we might think that if S weren't there, B would have caused J. Turn Bruno around so that he's going to be aimed at the jar. You might think his arm is a little slower. His pitch is a little slower. Sylvia's pitch hits the jar, breaks it. Well, once the jar is broken, you can't break it again, right? It wouldn't be there, it wouldn't be as tall, and Bruno's pitch just glides right over it. I'm trying to represent what would have happened by the dashed line. Okay. Now the problem with the sufficiency view is that S, on this picture now, S is not supposed to be a cause after all. If S had misfired, J would have happened via B anyway. Or B's causation was preempted by S. So the reason why this is troubling, right? Is we are supposed to get at the answer S caused J. Right. That's what we want, that's the correct answer. We want to get S caused J. But the counterfactual analysis that we have it here, the sufficiency form of the counterfactual analysis, doesn't get us there. Moreover, if we add the necessary version, it says that S is not supposed to be a cause. Now, in a weird way, right? With the counterfactual analysis, the super simple version, B is not supposed to be a cause either. Because if B had misfired, J would have happened via S. Right? If B weren't there, this is the picture of the world. Well, J, you know, if absent B, J would have happened via S. If S weren't there, J would have happened via B. Well, the weird thing now is we are now led to conclude that J has no cause. B wasn't essential to J's breaking. S wasn't essential to J's breaking. J broke. We know that much. But we have no cause of J's breaking if the analysis is correct. That should seem puzzling. Any resistance to this objection so far? Yeah.
It seems like something has to cause J.
Like, I agree, yeah.
Like, in a situation like where you know, there's this, like some phenomenon that happens, and there's two possible things, it seems like one of the things has to be, you know, like, Sylvia's fall had to have arrived first for it to break. So why can't we just go ahead and reject B?
I think you're right. We can reject B. But the issue is, right, you're entirely right. We want to get at this, we want to get at the notion. We want to endorse the claim. J broke, and there's a cause for J's breaking. And we moreover want to get at the notion that S caused J to break, or S caused J. The problem is, what will be the analysis? What will be the principle behind that thought? If it's the counterfactual analysis, we get the wrong answer. Right. I mean, you might think of it in terms of, you know, algebra, right? You want to get a certain answer for x. You're making the function. The problem is we're making the function wrongly, because it's spitting out the wrong answer. It's spitting out an answer that s is not a cause. It's spitting out the answer j has no cause. So there's something wrong about how we've built the function. There's something wrong with our alleged analysis. But you're entirely right. The whole idea is that we're trying to build the function. We're trying to build the formula to output intuitive judgments. S caused J. J has a cause. B wasn't a cause of J. I mean, that might be more controversial. But we're building the function to get the right answer. What we all intuitively are supposed to say is the right answer. So the hitch is something's wrong with the function. You know, something's wrong with our formula. It's not outputting the right answer. So that's a preemption case. Oh, this is to say what I just said. We should mark S as a cause, whatever else we are to say. That's the right answer. Something wrong with the machine we've built. More trouble with the machine we've built. Here's another picture of the world. A causes B, B causes C. We're supposed to say those things. That's the way the world is, and that's what a true statement of the world would be like. Now, the counterfactual analysis, so phrased, says, look, we can say, if no A, no C. That's fine. There's no other arrows getting to C, right? So if A hadn't occurred, then C wouldn't have occurred. So, quite rightly, or intuitively, A is a cause of C. Fine. But also, if no C, no A. So C is a cause of A. Because you can say, were it the case that C hadn't happened, A wouldn't have happened either. That's just formally similar to the counterfactual analysis we've been playing with. If C hadn't have happened, A wouldn't have happened. Well, if that's true, are we licensed to say that C is a cause of A? We're supposed to say, no, C is not a cause of A. Whatever else we are to say, whatever function we are to build, we're supposed to output the answer that C is not a cause of A. But the function we've built, the little machine that spits out terms, is leading us to this conclusion. C is a cause of A. Any questions about that? Yeah.
Would it be leading us to that conclusion if we're considering like the idea of it being necessary and sufficient? Because if C... Sorry, I'm just sort of thinking about that.
Let's take it step by step. Very good. Let's take it step by step. Put aside this question of whether or not dependence is necessary or sufficient. Let's just first ask about dependence. Does A depend on C? I want to say A does, in the sense that if C, were it the case that C hadn't have happened, then A wouldn't have happened. See, that's true. So A depends on C. Now, if we think that the dependence relation is sufficient, that gets us to the claim that C is a cause of A. So the first point of pressure is to say, here's a picture, and it looks like we're entitled to say that A depends on C. Right? Intuitively, of course, C depends on A. But just as permissibly, we are to say that A depends on C. So there's a dependence relation. And if you believe that it's sufficient, then we get to the weirdo conclusion that C is a cause of A. Something should smell fishy. Something's gone wrong in our little engine.
But is it always the case that, like, if C had to happen, A wouldn't happen? Are we just supposed to assume that?
We're assuming, right, exactly. We're assuming that.
Okay.
We're assuming the case where this is, you know, we're assuming that bit of the world where this is a true picture of it.
Okay.
Right. Of course, the cases in which there are other pictures, you know, there's all these, we could have a picture of the world that looks like this.
Right.
You know, there's a region of the ballpark that looks, that is well described by this picture. There's some other region of the world, it's look kind of simple, I don't know, me getting up, going to, it's a pretty simple little picture, that, for whatever part of the world, that's a true picture, of which that's a true picture. We get this weirdo, something's wrong. At least something feels wrong. Any other thoughts on that so far? Just to keep on, we're working with the counterfactual analysis and I'm trying to attack it. Perhaps beating a dead horse. Now, you might think, look, there's gotta be a way out from this. There's gotta be a way out from the claim that C is a cause of A. There's gotta be a way out from the view that the counterfactual analysis must be committed to outputting such an absurd answer. What would be a way out?
You could say that this does not exist in the world and every event must have an error. Every event must
every cause, every effect must have a cause which is antecedent in time. That is exactly the natural way out. The natural way of getting out of this problem. Which is a very good segue to this slide. So I read your mind. Causes, right? So we add into the counterfactual analysis another provision. Oh, by the way, not just the stuff about dependence, but by the way, in addition, causes must precede their effects. This is supposed to eliminate that goofy, absurd conclusion that C is the cause of A. Supposed to get rid of that untenable thought. It excludes it by a separate provision, right? Another way of putting it, you know, to use my algebraic form, right? You just add in another bit of your f of x. You add in another bit of your function so that it just doesn't output the wrong answer. Reply to the objection. It's no go. At least it's not enough to get us out of this trap. Here we have A causing B, here we have A causing C. C, let's read left to right, C is later in time than B. Still, if C hadn't have happened, A wouldn't have happened. If A wouldn't have happened, B wouldn't have happened. Therefore, C causes B. Even when we abide by this additional provision. Because it's still true. Oh, no, it's the other way around, sorry. If B hadn't happened, if B, it weren't the case that B didn't happen, then A wouldn't have happened. If A weren't to have happened, C wouldn't have happened. It is still true that B precedes C, so now we're licensed to say that B causes C. Yeah.
Can you give an example of
this ladder, this no-go picture?
Yeah.
What's that?
A two-bullet gun. A gun that's pointed two directions.
Yeah, think of it a gun that's pointed two directions, or I make a loud noise, it spills coffee. Somebody at a distant end of the room gets frightened. something like that. So, like, we're saying that the coffee spilling frightened, you know, that's the problem. We want to say that the noise caused someone to get frightened. Or like the movement of the cup on the table caused someone to get frightened. That movement of the cup on the table also caused the coffee to get spilled. It would be weird to say that the spilling of the coffee caused somebody to get frightened or something like that. Yeah?
Would that be sort of like how there was a recent case where there was a young boy who ran over some people and then they said it wasn't his fault because he had affluenza? Because he was wealthy, then he was spoiled.
Oh, right, I remember
reading
the Huffington Post thing about that.
Affluenza.
Yeah, affluenza. So, is affluenza causes what? him to run over somebody. It also causes him to go to jail. I'm not sure. You can just say that anytime there's a cause that has two effects, and the effects are indexed in time differently, they occupy different spatio-temporal slices, this picture should apply. The thing with the affluenza thing is hard because it's something about moral responsibility, which is kind of messing things up, right? Something like, well, maybe that'll work. Maybe, you know, it's being stricken with affluenza causes him not to be morally responsible. But then it seems like it's the lack of moral responsibility, a lack of a conscience or whatever you want to call it, that causes him to run over a bunch of innocent people or whatever. I mean, so it seems like, I'm not sure, but it seems like that is a different sort of picture. That's just an ABC kind of picture. Running over a bunch of people? And then we might say lack of legal responsibility. We are supposed to say lack of legal responsibility causes him to run over people. But the thing is, that might be right, but the thing is, I want to say, that sounds right to me. I'm willing to say, if someone lacks responsibility, that can explain all kinds of horrible things that they do. Like if they lack a sense of responsibility. That's why part of me wants to say, this is what's going on. I mean, whatever, affluenza is causing this person not to have a critical conscience, and it's the lack of a critical conscience in some sense. We have to play, I mean, it's weird, the lack of a critical conscience is an omission, so that's the possession of a really bad conscience causes all kinds of horribly, willfully bad behavior. So part of me wants to say the affluenza example is just a straightforward one. I mean, there's ways of describing the case, which could perhaps fit this mold. We would have to describe it, I think, a little bit differently. Yeah?
So I have a question about this no-go on the bottom, because earlier we talked about the example where we had the jar breaking and two people throwing at the jar, and one person not throwing at the jar doesn't necessarily mean the jar won't break, because you have another person.
Right, it's redundant.
So doesn't that apply to this, then, if you're using B and C reciprocally to show that A must exist? So since A depends on both of those, does that mean that both of them have to happen for A to happen? Or does it mean that one of the two must happen for A to happen?
That's a very good question. I mean, it seems like, I have to think more about it, but I think that I would want to say, the question you're raising is, does A depend on the joint condition, B and C? Yeah, I think so. I have to think more about whether or not, like, I want to rest with that thought, but whether I'm committed to it, or like whether me pantomiming this view is committed to it. But I think I'm okay with it. That's how that's how it works with philosophy. Is that, you know, we're attracted into certain forms of words, but we're not sure whether we really like that way of putting things just yet. We're not yet sure of all the nooks and crannies in that commitment, and it takes time to figure out whether there's some horrible, horrible, you know, gaping hole in that thought. And it's hard sometimes to figure out whether there is or isn't. But I want to say that sounds right to me. Yeah.
Yeah, please.
I was asking did you saw the movie The Matrix?
The
Matrix movie?
Oh, yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, it's a kind
long time
of, a kind of that scene when the oracle says to Neo that don't break the flowers,
uh-huh.
You know, and then he turns and he breaks the flower.
The vase or whatever?
Yeah. So that means that Neo was the B and A was
the oracle,
and C was the effect. That will always happen, even if she doesn't say nothing.
So she says, yada, 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 that causes... Maybe, but that's, to me that looks like this again. Because the oracle utters words into Neo's ear.
Okay.
And then Neo causes the vase or what, I don't remember it exactly, the vase to break.
But what she explains was like, that will happen, even if she doesn't say nothing.
Oh! I see what you're saying. No matter what happens, that vase is gonna, matter what she does.
Yeah, no matter what...
Yeah, so I guess you could... So you could have you have a dotted line here.
Yeah.
With another... Or like a dotted looped line saying that Even if, I don't know how to phrase it, even if Neo had like evaporated right before she uttered those words, it would have been the case somehow. It, you know, that's the dashed line articulates the counterfactual error. It would have been the case that the vase broke. So I think that maybe that would be the right way of picturing that case, is a dotted line to see. Maybe that'll work. I mean, dotted here. I don't know. I mean, I think that that's the way I would want to picture it. I don't know. Did you want to follow up with that?
Yeah, I mean, no, it's a kind of, that change the cows that are, the cow is not anymore the subject, but is, if you spell the cow, if you spell it the cows, if you say a word, that will cows everything, that will change the thing, how they will go. Well, it was in that kind of movie, but I mean...
Yeah. I mean, I think it's good to think about that. I think the question is, we're not yet clear on what it means for her to have said and to have spoken truly, the oracle's a woman, right? That the vase would have broken no matter what I said. I'm not quite sure if that, I mean, this, or is he saying the vase would have broken no matter what you did, right? Then the question is, what exactly is the real cause of the vase? You know, is it something that Neo, you know, is Neo dropping out? Is she dropping out? Is it the vase would have broken even if I, the oracle, had poofed or something?
Yeah.
Was that another question? Yeah.
I had a question. So with the affluenza thing, would it make sense in the Novo if A was affluenza, B was lack of responsibility, and then C was the prosecutor's decision not to hold them responsible? Would that make sense or no? Because there was, the prosecutors didn't have them go to jail or anything like that. Or would
that
be
might
the
work.
ABC at the top?
Yeah, that might. I think that looks like this. I think that's right, because it's not as though the lack of moral responsibility is causing the prosecutor's behavior. I mean, the prosecutor could have decided this even if B, right? Even if it's false that this person had a bad conscience or whatever, and the prosecutor just could be behaving because of some false view that he or she has. Okay, let's maybe move on, right? The absurd claim, C, B causes C. There's more trouble and more for diagrams. Maybe I'll do this real quick. It's a very similar one we just saw. It's very similar to the jar one, right? A causes B, B causes C. Same time. D causes E. But when this causal history is going on, C nullifies E. That's, I'm representing it by that little dot. These are, by the way, these are what's known as neural network diagrams or neuron diagrams. It nullifies this neuron so that normally E could cause C. But this, it's like a sort of a short circuit. It's cutting off E so that E didn't cause C. Although, had A not happened, then B wouldn't have happened, then C wouldn't have happened, and if C wouldn't have happened, then E plus D would have happened, and E would have caused C. It's another form of preemption, right? This causality is preempted, but late, by this causal history. Yeah.
Once E happened to cause C, would that cause C to nullify E and then cut it off? Or is C nullifying E only in effect of...
Yeah, so we have to imagine it... You know, the best way to think about it is... Once E hits C, this line has to turn like dotted. Because, I mean, C happens.
Right. Yeah.
And E already happened. And so, you know, once the train's left the station, by the time you get back to the station, there's no train there. So we have to think about it that way, yeah. Very good. That's good. I mean, that's the natural thought, is to figure out, well, there's something kind of fishy about this diagram. That's exactly right. If we build temporality into it, we get out of the fishiness. Another fun one, I think people can figure this out. Let's move on. The counterfactual analysis. So far we've been dealing with the simple version. Dependence, necessary and sufficient. I've raised a bunch of objections. As in, there's all these counterexamples. All these bad answers are getting spit out by the function, by the analysis. So here's a more sophisticated one. It's the same picture as before. Paul the Pots is going this way. This is a case of preemption. S is causing J, but if S hadn't caused J, B would have caused J. That's just the one that we had before. It's the same idea as the jars. Right? Sylvie's throwing at the jar and breaks it, but if Sylvie hadn't thrown, Bruno would have broken the jar. So, here's the more sophisticated version. If no S, then still J, but J would have been very different. Right. Now we want to look at the event of J happening, but we're making it very, very fine-grained. So, if no S, if no Sylvie, then no J in such and such a manner. It's true that if there were no J, Bruno would have broken the jar, but he would have broken the jar in a very different way. You know? Instead of the jar being hit from this angle, it gets hit from this angle. And when it gets hit from this angle, the shards are different. So we go really fine-grained about what kind of J event we want, and then we're allowed to say, so S is a cause of J in such and such a form. We get really specific. Because if S hadn't have happened, weren't to have happened, not the right kind of J would have happened. How do people feel about this, right? This way of defending the counterfactual analysis says, look, you've been too general in your talk about events J, S, B. Right? If we get really specific about the relevant event that is supposed to hang, supposed to depend on Sylvie's throw, then we're allowed to defend the counterfactual analysis from these objections. All right, pass over. The Tuck reading rehearses the objections. The Tuck reading rehearses why we should not want to go with this way out. If we get very fine-grained about our events, there's some big costs, right? Then a meeting can never be delayed. If we get really fine-grained about how we carve up the events of the world, we get a lot of specificity, but we're going to lose a lot of our normal right answers, right? You caused the meeting to get delayed. No, I didn't cause that meeting to get delayed. I caused some other meeting, right? If we get really fine-grained about when the meeting occurs, who's at the meeting, this and that, then we lose our grip on some right answers that we want to say. That's a Tuck reading. More resistance. This is the Strebbins case. Sylvie throws, at the same time Bruno throws, they collide, Sylvie's ball breaks J. Bruno's throw goes off into the distance. Strebbins has tried to rig the example so that in the real world, S breaks J in a certain place, at a certain time, right here, right at this little pixel. And if S hadn't have happened, or if were it the case that S hadn't happened, that's exactly the same place and the same velocity and the same force that Bruno's ball would have hit. So even if you want to go really fine-grained, you still get the wrong answer. This, if we can imagine it, this is the world in which the fine-grained specification or indexing of events is not enough to get us out of the counterexample. Because we still get the claim that S is not a cause of J. We're supposed to get the answer that S is a cause of J. If you don't like this idea of like perfect collisions, imagine that B through a smart rock, some sort of drone rock, and it's super smart, and it's going through the air, and it's going to hit the place exactly where S's ball would have gone. Right? Just think about some very sophisticated piece of machinery. Okay, we can end with this. What I want to suggest here, right, is we are a little bit at a standstill. Right? We have the counterfactual analysis. I've raised trouble with it. Now, one way out. Right, so then the question is, well, what in the world is causation if it can't be the counterfactual analysis? One way of going forward is to think that there's sort of two concepts of causation. One is the one we've been attacking, the notion of causation as dependence. This is associated, as we've been arguing, with the counterfactual analysis. It's also associated with causal influence. We'll hear Winship on causal influence. It seems to be the one endorsed by Jackson and Pettit and List and Speakerman. They endorse, I urge people to go back to the List and Speakerman article and revisit the place where they talk about two concepts of causation. I've been trying to make trouble for this dependency view. What's the alternative? What you might call causation is production. Not about X hanging on Y, but saying what brought about X? What's the causal process? What's the mechanism? Right? Notice that all this talk about dependency abstracts from talk about mechanism. That's why I put up pictures of mechanisms that show that the counterfactual analysis gets the wrong answer. So the other way of thinking about causation is not about dependency, but about production. What are the mechanisms here that put into sequence a train of events there? Causation as production is a rival way of thinking about causation. It might have its problems, which we didn't explore today. I've been trying to make trouble for dependence. But when we think about production, Professor Hall will speak to us about process tracing, which is the method in the social sciences for working with the notion of causation as production. Whereas Winship will be talking about notions of causal influence in a statistical atmosphere, which is the notion operative if we think of causation as dependence. If we think of causation as production, we can call this not the counterfactual analysis, but perhaps barbarously, we can call this the sufficientarian analysis. That's also in the talk reading. He's trying to defend a notion of causation other than dependence. Now, I don't mean to say that dependence loses and production wins. It seems to me the case that both notions have their problems, which suggests that maybe there isn't one notion of causation that takes the field, but the field is carved up by different forms of causation, or different ways of asking the question. Oh, also you think of Elster and methodological individualism as being wedded, or at least at home, not in the dependency view, but in the production view. The final word I want to say is that we've been working with the idea that there's two possible forms of causation, dependency and production. Now, I just want to close with the thought that perhaps we should feel a little bit, we might be a little bit suspicious that a lot of our examples have been basically working in the model of billiard balls, things hitting other things. We haven't really, I think, taken seriously in either of these forms of causation the notion of actions as being distinctive kinds of events, intentional actions being distinctive kinds of events. If we think with Skinner that an action is an intention, and we think that an intention is a thought, we are led to the conclusion that action is constituted sometimes by thought. We are also led to the conclusion that action is explained by thought non-causally, in Skinner's words. I want to leave you with the thought that all of this stuff about causation might be better thought of in the human case, in human action, by leaving open the question whether or not intentional action is caused by thought in a distinctive sense of cause. In other words, Skinner is willing to say that action explanation does not have to be causal explanation. If this lecture has moved you in the right direction, it is perhaps to lead us that we don't really have a very clear view about what causation is anyway, and we might allow ourselves to flirt with the idea that intentional action is explained causally, but in a very distinctive notion of causality. I'll leave that. Thank you for your kind attention.